clandestine activities. His daughter seemed to become little British girls overnight, talking to their dolls in English. He loved London's parks and pubs, the little Middle Eastern restaurants of Kensington with their exotic spicy smells. In contrast to Yelena, Layla loved to cook, and never ceased to report with wonder on the vast array of ingredients available in British shops. The household chores and child-rearing were left entirely to Layla. Far from complaining, she frequently remarked on her good fortune to be able to live abroad for a time. She missed her family and friends back in Moscow, but she knew they would be returning home soon enough, since Soviet diplomatic postings were seldom extended beyond 3 years. Whenever Layla grew homesick, Oleg tried to change the subject. One day, he knew, he would have to tell her that he was a spy for Britain and they were never going back. But why expose her to the stress and danger now? Layla was a good Russian wife, he told himself, and when the time came to reveal his deception, though she might be shocked and unhappy for a while, she would accept it. But she would have to learn the truth sooner or later. Later seemed the preferable option. They immersed themselves in the artistic life of the British capital, attending classical music concerts, gallery openings, and theatrical performances. His spying for the West was, he believed, the act of a cultural dissident, not a turncoat. Just as Shostakovich, the composer, fought back with music, and Solzhenitsyn, the writer, fought back with words, so I, the KGB man, could only operate through my own intelligence world. He fought back with secrets. Every morning he would run in Holland Park, and every week or so, on a different, prearranged day, when MI5's watchers were known to be elsewhere, he would tell colleagues he was meeting a contact for lunch, climb into his car, and drive to the safe house in Bayswater. In the underground garage, he pulled a plastic cover over his car to conceal the diplomatic plates. The center no longer sent its instructions on microfilm, so Gordievsky found himself smuggling out physical documents before each meeting, sometimes in batches. He would wait until the office emptied before discreetly tucking the papers into a pocket. There were plenty to choose from. The different departments in the center competed in making demands on the London Residentura's numerous personnel. 23 KGB officers within the embassy, another 8 working undercover at the Soviet trade delegation, 4 more posing as journalists, as well as illegals, and a separate posse of 15 military intelligence officers deployed by the GRU. The center churned out an immense volume of information, any of which I was at liberty to pass on. Once Gordievsky was inside the flat, Spooner debriefed him while Veronica Price made lunch, and Sarah Page, an MI6 secretary of gentle charm and extreme efficiency, photographed any documents in the bedroom. After completing the excavation of Gordievsky's memory, the focus shifted to current operations. Quite quickly, we were into live stuff, said Spooner. He would bring us up to date on everything that had happened in the intervening period. Events, instructions, visits, local activity, conversations with Residentura colleagues. A trained observer, Oleg made mental notes of anything and everything that might be of use. Instructions from the center, the latest Ryan requests and reports, the activity of illegals and clues to their identities, targets of cultivation, agent recruitment and staff changes. But he also brought gossip and rumor, tidbits revealing what his colleagues were thinking, plotting and doing after hours, how much they were drinking, whom they were sleeping with, whom they wanted to sleep with. You are an extra member of the KGB Residentura, Gordievsky told Spooner. From time to time, Veronica Price would go over the details of Operation Pimlico, in case he was suddenly recalled to Moscow and needed to escape. The exfiltration plan had undergone some important modifications since it was first conceived. Gordievsky was now a married man with 2 young children. MI6 would therefore provide not 1 escape car, but 2. 1 adult and 1 child would be hidden in each trunk, and the girls would be injected with a strong soporific drug to make them sleep and reduce the trauma. To prepare for the time when he might have to drug his own daughters at the moment of exfiltration, Veronica Price produced a syringe and an orange for him to practice administering injections. Every few months, he would weigh his daughters. The weights would be reported to the MI6 station in Moscow, and the dosage in the waiting syringes would be adjusted accordingly. The case developed its own rhythm, yet the tension was relentless. After one meeting at the safe flat, Oleg went to retrieve his car from nearby Connaught Street, for once he had decided not to park in the underground garage. As he was about to step off the pavement, he saw, to his horror, Gook's ivory Mercedes gliding toward him down the road with the fat resident at the wheel. Thinking he had been spotted, Gordievsky broke into a sweat and immediately began inventing reasons to explain what he was doing in a residential neighborhood away from the embassy. But Gook, it seems, had not seen him. Only three politicians were brought into the circle of trust. Margaret Thatcher was indoctrinated into the Nocton case on December 23, 1982, fully 6 months after Gordievsky's arrival in Britain. The raw intelligence was placed in a special red folder, known as a red jacket, and placed inside a locked blue box to which only the Prime Minister, her foreign advisor, and her private secretary had the key. Thatcher was informed that MI6 had an agent within the KGB's London station. She did not know his name. William Whitelaw, her Home Secretary, was informed a month later. The only other cabinet minister in the know was the Foreign Secretary. The Nocton material, most notably Operation Ryan, made a powerful impression on Geoffrey Howe when he took up that post. The Soviet leadership really did believe the bulk of their own propaganda. They did have a genuine fear that the West was plotting their overthrow and might, just might, go to any lengths to achieve it. But while Gordievsky's espionage for MI6 prospered mightily, his work for the KGB was bogging down. Gook and Nikitenko, the resident and his deputy, were openly hostile. Igor Titov, his immediate boss, was consistently unfriendly. But not all of his colleagues were paranoid Philistines. Some were highly perceptive. Maxim Parshikov, a fellow PR line officer in his 30s, was the son of a Leningrad artist who shared many of Gordievsky's cultural tastes. They listened to classical music on Radio 3 while working at adjacent desks in the political section. Parshikov found his colleague agreeable and intelligent, with an education and a level of culture that set him apart. When Parshikov caught a cold, Gordievsky introduced him to the nasal decongestant Otrivin, which he had recently discovered in a British pharmacy. "We were united in our love of classical music and Otrivin," Parshikov wrote. Yet he sensed Gordievsky's internal anxiety. "For me and others who were close to Oleg during his first months in London, it was obvious that something serious and uneasy was happening in his life. He seemed extremely nervous and under pressure. There was something different about the new man, a tense reserve." As Parshikov said, "The leadership of the Residentura disliked him from the start. He did not drink in the usual way. He was too intellectual. He was not one of us. Imagine a typical party to mark a Soviet holiday in a small central room of the residency. Everything is as it should be. On the table are sandwiches and fruit, vodka and whiskey for the men, a bottle of wine for the few ladies. Toasts are drunk, one by one, starting with the resident. Gordievsky voluntarily assumes the role of butler, obligingly filling every empty glass, except his own, which contains only red wine. He never really fraternized. Some found it weird, but I thought, what the hell? You come across different people in our ranks. The wife of one officer could not stand Gordievsky. She could not explain the reason for her dislike, but she thought Oleg somehow wrong, unnatural, with two faces." Parshikov paid little attention to the bad-mouthing. "I was too lazy to get involved with slandering my nice colleague in the Residentura." Gordievsky's main problem, Parshikov reflected, was his failing job performance. His English was still poor. He seemed to head off to lunch with some regularity, but came back with little new information. Within months of his arrival, a whispering campaign had begun in the gossip-soaked Residentura to the effect that Oleg was not up to the job. Gordievsky knew he was floundering. He had inherited a number of contacts from his predecessor in the PR line, but these provided no useful intelligence. He contacted a European diplomat, identified by the center as an agent, and found that, although he was prepared to eat large meals, he never told me anything of the slightest interest. Another individual identified for possible recruitment was Ron Brown, the Labour MP for Edinburgh Leith, a former trade union organiser who had attracted the KGB's attention by his vocal support for communist regimes in Afghanistan, Albania and North Korea. He was frequently in trouble with the parliamentary authorities for rowdy behaviour and would eventually be expelled from the Labour Party after stealing his mistress's underwear and wrecking her flat. Born in Leith, Brown had a Scottish accent as thick as porridge. He was colourful, convivial and, to Russian ears, almost completely incomprehensible. Gordievsky, who had difficulty enough following the received English pronunciation of the BBC, took Brown out to lunch on several occasions and sat nodding intelligently, grasping one word in ten while the Scotsman burbled away in his native brogue. For all I understood, he could have been talking Arabic or Japanese. Back at the Residentura, Gordievsky wrote up a report that was pure fabrication, based on what he thought the Scot might have said. Brown may have been leaking top-grade secrets, but, equally, he might have been talking about football. Brown's guilt or innocence remains a historical mystery, hidden forever behind his impenetrable Scottish accent. Reviving and consolidating old contacts was as frustrating as trying to find new ones. Bob Edwards was nearly 80, the oldest sitting MP, an unrepentant friend of the KGB who was happy to chat about the old days, but had very little to reveal about the new ones. Gordievsky also re-established contact with Jack Jones, the former trade union leader, and met him in his flat. Long retired, Jones was delighted to accept lunch and occasional disbursements of cash, but as an informant he was absolutely useless. The centre frequently identified prominent progressives, such as the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament campaigner Joan Ruddock and the broadcaster Melvin Bragg, in the belief that, with the right approach, they might spy for the Soviets. In this, as in so much else, the KGB was mistaken. For weeks, Gordievsky floated around the fringes of the Labour Party, the peace movement, the British Communist Party, and the trade unions, trying and failing to cultivate new contacts. After 6 months, he had little to show for his efforts. The Residentura's chief analyst, another of Gook's cronies, was scathing about Gordievsky's work and began complaining that the new man was an incompetent dud. Gordievsky confided to Parshikov that he was afraid to return to Moscow on annual leave, fearing that he might be criticized for his poor performance. The center was unsympathetic. "Stop panicking and keep working." Gordievsky was in trouble. Disliked by the resident, unpopular within the embassy, and struggling to make an impression in a new post, a new language, and a new city. He was also so busy gathering information for the British, there was insufficient time to devote to his KGB day job. Gordievsky's problems in his day job presented MI6 with an unexpected and alarming dilemma. If he was sent home, the West's most important spy case would come to a halt, just as it was beginning to produce intelligence of world-changing importance. The case depended on Gordievsky's professional progress, because the more he succeeded in the eyes of the KGB, the better his promotion prospects, and the wider his access to useful material. His KGB career needed a boost. MI6 decided to bring this about in two unprecedented ways, by doing the spy's homework for him and by disposing of those who stood in his way. Martin Shawford, a young MI6 officer in the Nocton cell within the Soviet branch, was assigned the task of making Gordievsky look good in the eyes of his peers and bosses. Speaking Russian and newly returned from a posting in Moscow, Shawford handled political reporting from the case. He began to pull together information that Gordievsky could pass off as his own and feed back to the KGB. Enough to convince the center that he was an expert in gathering political intelligence, but not so good that it might actually prove useful to the Soviets. In spy jargon, such information is known as chicken feed, genuine but not seriously damaging information that can be given to an enemy to establish an agent's bona fides, bulky, filling, but lacking in any real nutritional value. British intelligence had become expert in manufacturing chicken feed during the Second World War, passing vast quantities of carefully monitored information through double agents to their German handlers. Some true, some half-true, and some false, but undetectably so. Shawford combed open-source information, such as magazines and newspapers, for nuggets of information Gordievsky could have gleaned from contacts or other sources. Summaries of the situation in apartheid South Africa, the state of the Anglo-American relationship, or internal gossip from the Conservative Party gathered on the fringes of party conferences. With some imagination, these could be made to seem like gathered intelligence. We needed material he could feed back into the Residentura to justify his absences, his meetings, and so on. It was important to build up his credibility and justify his movements. We knew what sort of chit-chat he might be picking up from the sort of people he knew. MI6's demands for releasable material were such that K6, the MI5 department responsible for the case, struggled to keep up. This caused almost the only friction between the services in the history of the Gordievsky case. Shawford would type up a 3/4-page summary every week, which Gordievsky took back to the Residentura, translated into KGB language, added a few details of his own, and handed to the bosses. The original MI6 crib sheet he tore into shreds and washed down the toilet. But feeding Oleg chicken feed was only one way of fattening up his career prospects. In order to convince his superiors that he was working well, Gordievsky needed to meet real people who could supply him with genuine, though valueless, information. Simply offering reams of information without a named source would eventually invite suspicion. Gordievsky needed his own confidential contacts, so MI6 gave him some. Within MI5, Department K4 handled counter-espionage against Soviet targets, identifying, monitoring, tailing, and, whenever possible, neutralizing spies active in Britain, KGB and GRU officers, their recruits, and illegals. This frequently involved the use of access agents, people in civilian life who could make contact with a suspected spy, gain his confidence, draw him out, extract information, and pretend to be sympathetic and available for recruitment. If the spy revealed himself, he could be arrested if he was an illegal or expelled if he was in Britain under diplomatic cover. But the ultimate aim of any such operation was to lure a spy into complicity and then persuade him, by inducement or threat, to spy against the Soviet Union. These access agents, also known as controlled contacts, were ordinary men and women, secretly recruited by K4 to lend a hand in the unseen espionage battle. They were, in effect, dangles. They were also, by definition, the sorts of people a Soviet intelligence officer might want to recruit. In the early 1980s, K4 was simultaneously running dozens of cases against Soviet targets, using scores of undercover access agents. The striking, tall, dark-haired figure of Rosemary Spencer was a familiar sight in Conservative Central Office, the nerve center of the Tory party based at 32 Smith Square, in the heart of Westminster. Miss Spencer, 42 years old, worked in the international section of the research department and had helped to draw up the Franks report into the Falklands War. People said, rather unkindly, that she was married to the party. She was convivial, clever, possibly rather lonely, and just the kind of well-informed member of the political establishment that the KGB encouraged its officers to recruit. Her conservative colleagues would have been staggered to discover that the jolly, single woman in the research department was really an undercover agent for MI5. Gordievsky first encountered Rosemary Spencer at a party in Westminster. Their meeting was not accidental. He had been told to look out for a vivacious Tory researcher. She had been warned that she might be approached by a KGB officer posing as a Russian diplomat, and if so, she should encourage the relationship. They met for lunch. Gordievsky was at his most charming. He knew she was an MI5 access agent. She knew he was KGB. She did not know he was actually working for MI6. They lunched again, and then again. Rosemary's MI5 handler advised her on what information she might pass over. Nothing too sensitive, but items of interest from her work. Snippets of insider Tory gossip. Morsels of chicken feed. These Gordievsky typed up into a report, which included not just what Rosemary had told him, but other information supplied by MI6 that a well-connected member of the Conservative Party might have told him. The KGB was duly impressed. Gordievsky was cultivating an important new source inside the Conservative Central Office, who might eventually develop into a confidential contact, or even an agent. The relationship between Gordievsky and Spencer became a solid friendship, but it was also one of deception. She believed she was deceiving him, and he was deceiving her by allowing her to think that. He was using her to improve his standing within the KGB. She thought she was striking a blow against the Soviet Union. Here was another example of the combined trickery and tenderness inherent in espionage, a friendship between a British Tory researcher and a Russian Soviet diplomat, both of whom were secret spies. They were lying to each other with genuine affection. Within the KGB Residentura, Gordievsky's stock rose rapidly. Even Gook seemed to be warming to him. Reports to the center were signed by the Resident, and Gordievsky's work was beginning to make Gook look good. Parshikov noticed a marked change in Gordievsky's demeanor. He began to get used to the team, to build relationships with people. He seemed more confident and relaxed. One person who did not appreciate Gordievsky's success was his immediate superior, Igor Titov. The head of the PR line had always regarded his subordinate as a threat, and Gordievsky's knowledgeable reports and new raft of sources redoubled his determination to stymie his underling's chances of promotion. Gordievsky was on the way up, but Titov was in the way. So MI6 removed him. In March 1983, Igor Titov was declared persona non grata in the UK and ordered to leave the country immediately. Gordievsky was informed in advance of the plan to throw out his boss. To deflect suspicion, two GRU officers were simultaneously expelled for activities incompatible with their diplomatic status, the accepted euphemism for espionage. Titov was enraged. "I am no spy," he lied to reporters. Few in the KGB station were sorry to see him go, and fewer were surprised. The preceding months had seen a flurry of spy expulsions in Western countries, and there was ample evidence to indicate Titov was an active KGB officer. With Titov eliminated, Gordievsky was the obvious candidate to succeed him as head of political intelligence. He was promoted to the rank of lieutenant colonel. MI6's ruse to bump their spy up the KGB ranks worked perfectly. By the middle of 1983, he had been transformed from an unpopular failure in danger of losing his job into the rising star of the Residentura, with a burgeoning reputation for recruiting agents and gathering intelligence, and his manufactured promotion had been achieved without raising a flicker of suspicion. As Parshikov observed, it all seemed quite natural. As chief of political intelligence in the Residentura, Gordievsky now had access to the PR line files, and was able to confirm what MI6 already suspected. Soviet penetration of the British establishment was pitiful, with just half a dozen people classed as recruited agents, mostly very old, and perhaps a dozen confidential contacts, mostly very minor. Many were merely paper agents, who were kept on the books in order to make officers look busy to Moscow. There was no new Philby hidden in the woodwork. More positively, Gordievsky's new position gave him increased insight into the workings of other departments or lines. Line X, scientific and technical, line N, illegals, and line KR, counterintelligence and security. Piece by piece, Gordievsky was cracking open the secrets of the KGB and passing them on to MI6. Yet another source of information became available when Leyla joined the KGB station as a part-time employee. Arkady Gook needed another secretary. Leyla was a fast and efficient typist. She was told to put her children into morning nursery and report for work at the Residentura. Henceforth, she would be typing Gook's reports. Leyla was in awe of the resident. He was a peacock. To be a KGB general, that was really something. I never asked questions, just typed what I was told to type. She did not notice how closely her husband was listening when, over dinner, she would describe her day, the reports she had typed up for the boss, and the gossip among the secretaries. Parshikov noted how happy his newly elevated boss seemed, and how generous. "Guys spend money on entertainment expenses," Gordievsky told his subordinates. "This year we spent very little on entertainment and gifts for contacts. If you don't, next year the allowance will be cut." It was a call to fiddle their expenses, and some of his colleagues needed no second invitation. Gordievsky had every reason to feel contented and confident. He was rising up the ranks. His position was secure. His intelligence hall was landing regularly on the desk of the British Prime Minister, and he was attacking from within the communist system he loathed. What could go wrong? On April 3rd, 1983, Easter Sunday, Arkady Guk returned to his flat in 42 Holland Park and found an envelope had been pushed through the letterbox. It contained a top-secret document, the MI5 legal brief outlining the case for expelling Titov and the two GRU men the previous month, including details of how all three had been identified as Soviet intelligence officers. In an accompanying note, the writer offered to provide more secrets and gave elaborate instructions on how to contact him. It was signed Koba, one of Stalin's early nicknames. Someone inside British intelligence was offering to spy for the Soviet Union. Chapter 9. Koba. Arkady Guk detected threats and conspiracies everywhere. The KGB resident in London saw them in the minds of his Soviet colleagues, behind the billboards in the London Underground, and in the invisible machinations of British intelligence. The letter from Koba sent his suspicious mind into a frenzy. The instructions it contained were detailed and explicit. Guk should indicate his willingness to cooperate by putting a single thumbtack at the top of the right-hand banister of the stairs from platforms 3 and 4 of the Piccadilly line at the Piccadilly Underground station. Koba would acknowledge receipt of the signal by wrapping a piece of blue adhesive tape around the telephone cable of the middle telephone box of a row of 5 on Adam and Eve Court off Oxford Street. He would then make the dead drop, a canister of film containing secret information, taped under the lid of the cistern of the gents' lavatory in the Academy Cinema, Oxford Street. Guk had until April 25th to accept the offer, 22 days hence. The resident took one look at the extraordinary letter and decided it must be a plant, a dangle by MI5, a deliberate provocation designed to trap him, embarrass the KGB, and then have him expelled. So he ignored it. Guk assumed rightly that his home must be under MI5 surveillance. A genuine spy inside British intelligence would surely know this, and would therefore not take the risk of being spotted delivering a packet to his front door. It did not occur to him that Koba could have access to MI5's surveillance schedules, and might therefore have chosen to make his delivery after midnight on Easter Sunday, when he knew there were no watchers on duty. Guk filed the package away, congratulating himself on having foiled so obvious a ruse. But Koba refused to be ignored. After 2 months of silence, on June 12th, a second packet plopped through Guk's letterbox in the middle of the night. This one was even more intriguing. It contained a 2-page MI5 document, a complete list of every Soviet intelligence officer in London. Each spy was graded as fully identified, more or less identified, or under suspicion of belonging to the KGB station. Once again, the accompanying note offered to supply further classified material, and suggested a new signaling system and a dead letterbox. If Guk wanted to make contact, he should park his ivory Mercedes during lunchtime on July 2nd or 4th at the parking meters on the north side of Hanover Square. If he received the signal, on July 23rd, the writer would leave a green Carlsberg beer can containing film at the foot of a broken lamppost without shade and leaning to one side on the footpath running parallel to Horsenden Lane in Greenford, West London. Guk should acknowledge receipt of the can and its contents by placing a piece of orange peel at the foot of the right-hand gatepost of the first entrance to St. James's Gardens in Melton Street by Euston Station. Again, the message was signed by Koba. Guk summoned Leonid Nikitenko, his counterintelligence chief, and behind closed doors in the embassy attic, Over vodka and cigarettes, they pricked over the mystery. Gook still insisted the approach was a clumsy plot. A spy who volunteers his services is known as a walk-in and is immediately more suspect than one who has been picked out for recruitment. The document revealed only what the KGB already knew, information that was correct but unhelpful. In other words, chicken feed. Once again, it does not seem to have occurred to him that Kobo was demonstrating his bona fides by deliberately furnishing information that Gook could verify. Nikitenko was less convinced this was an MI5 provocation. The document seemed authentic, a complete chart of the Residentura's order of battle drawn up by the security service. It was certainly accurate. The spycraft of signal sites and dead letter boxes was sufficiently complex to indicate someone who did not wish to be caught. To Nikitenko's yellow eyes, the offer looked genuine, but he was far too canny and ambitious to contradict his boss. The center was consulted, and the order came back. Do nothing, and see what transpires. Gordievsky sensed that something unusual was brewing in the station. Gook and Nikitenko kept disappearing into a private huddle and sending urgent telegrams to Moscow. The resident wore his most conspiratorial look. For a man steeped in paranoid secrecy, Gook could be surprisingly indiscreet. He was also a braggart. On the morning of June 17th, he called Gordievsky into his office, closed the door and asked portentously, "Would you like to see something exceptional?" Gook then pushed the two photocopied pages across his desk. "Boże mój," Gordievsky muttered softly. "My God, where did these come from?" He scanned the list of KGB officers and came to his own name. He was graded as more or less identified. He immediately grasped the implications. Whoever had compiled the list did not know for certain that he was a KGB agent, and whoever had passed it on could not know that he was secretly spying for Britain, because if he did, he would have betrayed him to Gook to protect himself from exposure. Koba clearly had access to secrets, but he did not know Gordievsky was a double agent. Yet. "It's pretty accurate," he said, handing back the document. "Yes," said Gook. "They've done well." Gordievsky got a closer look at the document when the deputy reports officer, Slava Mishustin, asked for help in translating it. Mishustin marveled that the British had been able to gather such precise information on the KGB personnel. Gordievsky had a pretty good idea where that information had come from. But he was more puzzled than alarmed. He tended to agree with Gook that the midnight deliveries to 42 Holland Park seemed more like a provocation than a genuine offer. British intelligence must be up to something. But if the Brits were attempting a dangle, why had Spooner not warned him? And would MI5 really want the KGB to know that it had correctly identified all its officers working in Britain? He slipped out at lunchtime and called the emergency number. Veronica Price answered immediately. "What is going on?" asked Gordievsky, before describing the mysterious deliveries to Gook's flat and the documents he had seen. For a moment, Veronica was silent. Then she said, "Oleg, we need to meet." James Spooner and Veronica Price were waiting at the safe house when Gordievsky appeared an hour later. "I know you wouldn't do this, but someone is messing us around," he said. Then he saw the look on Spooner's face. "Oh my God, you don't mean it's real?" Veronica spoke. "As far as we know, there is no provocation operation underway." Gordievsky later described the MI6 reaction as classically calm. In reality, the revelation that someone in British intelligence was volunteering to spy for the Soviets provoked consternation among the few made aware of it, accompanied by a horrible flood of déjà vu. As with Philby, Hollis, and other spy scandals of the past, British intelligence would now have to launch an internal mole hunt and try to dig out the traitor. If the mole got wind of the investigation, he might realize that someone inside the KGB Residentura had tipped off the British, and Gordievsky himself would be in danger. The walk-in was clearly well-placed, with access to classified material and a knowledge of spycraft. He or she had to be stopped before more damaging secrets were passed to the Soviets. Several thousand people worked for MI5 and MI6, Coba was among them. But in the feverish hunt that now ensued, British intelligence had one overriding advantage. The spy, whoever it was, did not know that Gordievsky was a double agent. If Coba had been part of the Nocturne team, he would never have made such an approach, knowing this would immediately be reported back to MI6 by Gordievsky, as had now happened. His first move would have been to expose Gordievsky to Gook and ensure his own safety. This had not happened. The search for the traitor should therefore be carried out exclusively by those officers who knew the Gordievsky secret and could be trusted completely. The mole hunt was codenamed Elmen, a municipality in the Austrian Tyrol. The handful of MI5 personnel indoctrinated into the Gordievsky case would be responsible for finding the internal mole, under the leadership of John Deverell, director of K, MI5's counterintelligence branch. Working out of Deverell's office, they were sealed off from the rest of MI5 while they dug, a secret cell within a secret department of a secret organization. Nobody outside the team noticed anything out of the ordinary. The Elmen team nicknamed themselves the Nadgers. This slang term is obscure, but appears to have been coined by Spike Milligan on The Goon Show in the 1950s to mean a non-specific affliction, disease, or illness, as in, I've got a nasty dose of the Nadgers. Nadgers is also slang for testicles. Eliza Manningham Buller had joined the security service in 1974 after being recruited at a party. The work was already in her DNA. Her father, a former attorney general, had prosecuted earlier spies, including George Blake, the MI6 double agent. During the Second World War, her mother trained carrier pigeons that were dropped into occupied France and used by the resistance to send messages back to Britain. Picked out as utterly reliable and discreet, she had been indoctrinated into the Gordievsky case early on and brought in to the tiny Lampard team, analyzing his output from Denmark and liaising with MI6. By 1983, she was in MI5's personnel department and ideally placed to search for the spy. Manningham Buller would become Director General of MI5 in 2002, rising to the pinnacle of a competitive world dominated by men. Her jolly hockey sticks manner was deceptive. She was direct, self-confident, and extremely clever. Despite the sexism and prejudice inside MI5, she was intensely loyal to the organization she called My Lot, and greatly shocked by the discovery of yet another traitor inside British intelligence. It was one of the nastiest times in my career, particularly in the early days, when you didn't know who it was, because you would get in the lift and look round and wonder. To avoid arousing suspicion among their colleagues, the Nadgers frequently met, after hours, in the Inner Temple flat belonging to Manningham Buller's mother. One of the team was heavily pregnant. Her unborn child was nicknamed Little Nadger. For an intelligence service, there is no process more painful and debilitating than an internal hunt for an unidentified traitor. The damage Philby did to MI6's self-confidence was far greater and more enduring than anything he inflicted by spying for the KGB. A mole does not just foment mistrust. Like a heretic, he undermines the coherence of faith itself. Manningham Buller and her fellow Nadgers called up the personnel files and began whittling down the list of potential traitors. The MI5 document outlining the case for expelling the three Soviet spies had been distributed in the Foreign Office, the Home Office, and 10 Downing Street. The chart listing all the Soviet intelligence officers had been drawn up by K4, MI5's Soviet counterintelligence branch, and 50 copies sent to various departments of the secret world. The mole hunters began by identifying everyone who might have had access to both documents. The investigation was running at full tilt in late June, when Oleg Gordievsky and his family flew back to Moscow. He was hardly in a holiday mood, but turning down his annual leave would have raised immediate suspicions. The risk was huge. Koba was still at large. At any moment, he might discover Gordievsky's activities and expose him to Gook. If that happened while he was in Moscow, Gordievsky might well not be coming back. The MI6 station in Moscow was placed on alert in case he needed to make contact or fly the escape signal. Meanwhile, The Nadjas were closing in on a man whose presence inside British intelligence seemed, in retrospect, like an unfunny joke. Michael John Bettany was a loner, unhappy and unstable. At Oxford University, he goose-stepped around his college quad and played Hitler's speeches loudly on a gramophone. He wore tweeds and brogues and smoked a pipe. He dressed like a bank manager and dreamt of being a stormtrooper, said one fellow undergraduate. He once set fire to himself after a party and briefly grew a toothbrush mustache, which girls did not find attractive. He changed his northern accent to an upper-class drawl. A later investigation described him as a man with a considerable sense of inferiority and insecurity. Raging insecurity is not an ideal quality in an officer of the security service, yet he was tapped up as a recruit while still at Oxford and joined MI5 in 1975. After a formal induction course, he was plunged into the deep end, combating terrorism in Northern Ireland. Bettany himself questioned whether, as a Catholic, he was suitable for the job. His doubts were overruled. This was grim work, complex and extremely dangerous. Running agents inside the IRA, tapping telephones, talking to unpleasant people in very unfriendly pubs, in the knowledge that a wrong move could mean a bullet in the head in a Belfast back street. Bettany was traumatized by the work, and not very good at it. His father died in 1977, and his mother a year later. Despite the double bereavement, Bettany's tour of duty in Belfast was extended. Looking back over his file, Eliza Manningham Buller was appalled. "We made Bettany what he became. He never recovered from Northern Ireland. He was a man with an accent, wardrobe, and image that was not his own, without family, friends, love, or settled convictions, looking for a cause and doing a job to which he was utterly unsuited. He was not authentic," said Manningham Buller. "The peculiar stress and secrecy of intelligence work may have pushed him ever further from reality. Bettany would probably have lived a contented and uneventful life if only he had chosen some other line of work." Back in London, he spent 2 years in the training department before being transferred, in December 1982, to K4, the MI5 section analyzing and combating Soviet espionage in the UK, including the running of Axis agents. He lived alone, with a large plastic figurine of the Madonna, a number of Russian icons, a drawer of Nazi war medals, and an extensive collection of pornography. Withdrawn and isolated, he repeatedly tried to persuade the female staff at MI5 to sleep with him, without success. He was occasionally overheard at parties, drunkenly shouting, "I'm working for the wrong side," and "Come and see me in my dacha when I retire." 6 months before the first delivery to Gook, Bettany had been found sitting on a sidewalk in London's West End, too inebriated to stand. When taken into custody for being drunk in a public place, he shouted at police, "You can't arrest me, I'm a spy." He was fined £10. MI5 did not accept his offer of resignation. This was an error. Michael Bettany should not have been allowed within a mile of a state secret, yet, by the age of 32, he had been in the security service for 8 years and had risen to become a middle-ranking officer in MI5's Soviet counter-espionage section. Obvious signs that he was heading off the rails had been noted but ignored. His Catholic faith suddenly evaporated. By 1983, he was drinking a bottle of spirits a day and was given some friendly advice by a supervisor to cut down his alcohol consumption. No further action was taken. Bettany, meanwhile, was taking action of his own. He began memorizing the contents of secret documents and taking longhand notes, later typing them up in his semi-detached house in the southern suburbs of London and photographing them. Whenever he was on night duty, he took a camera into MI5 and photographed whatever files he could lay his hands on. No one searched him. His colleagues called him Smiley, after John le Carré's fictional spymaster, but they also noted an air of superiority and bumptiousness. Like many spies, Bettany wanted to know and conceal a bigger secret than the spy sitting alongside him. There were 4 officers in K4. 2 of these were indoctrinated into the Gordievsky case. Bettany was not, but, both literally and metaphorically, he was sitting right next to the biggest secret in the organization, an MI6 spy inside the KGB's London Residentura. Bettany later claimed to have converted to Marxism in 1982, and insisted his desire to work for the KGB sprang from pure ideological conviction. In a long, self-justifying treatise, he painted his actions in the bright colours of political martyrdom, a strange confection of resentment, conspiracy theory, and righteous outrage. He accused the Thatcher government of slavish adherence to the aggressive and maverick policy of the Reagan administration, and deliberately increasing unemployment to bring greater wealth to those who already have too much. He claimed to be acting in pursuit of world peace, and attacked MI5 for using sinister and immoral methods, not merely to remove the Soviet government and party, but also to destroy the entire fabric of society in the USSR. He adopted the high-flown rhetoric of the revolutionary. I call on comrades everywhere to renew their determination and redouble their efforts in pursuit of a victory which is historically inevitable. Bettany's Marxist politics were as artificial as his fruity accent. He was never a committed communist in the Philby mode. There is little evidence he felt any particular affinity for the Soviet Union, the ineluctable march of communism, or the oppressed proletariat. In one unguarded moment, he gave himself away. I felt I needed radically to influence events. Bettany did not want money, revolution, or world peace. He wanted attention, which made it all the more hurtful when the KGB took no notice of him. Bettany was extremely surprised when his first delivery to Gook's letterbox elicited no response. He returned to Piccadilly Station several times, and when no thumbtack appeared in the banister, he concluded his choice of dead letterbox and signal site must have been too close to the Soviet embassy. His second set of instructions identified sites outside central London, suggested a signal date several weeks ahead, and provided one of the most secret recent documents in K4. Bettany waited, wondered, and drank. With hindsight, Bettany should have been identified as a risk years earlier. But the three most powerful spy agencies in the world, the CIA, MI6, and the KGB, were all, at different times, vulnerable to betrayal from within by people who seemed, on closer inspection, to stand out as highly suspicious. Intelligence agencies have a reputation for brilliant insight and cool efficiency. But despite close vetting of candidates, they are just as likely to hire and retain the wrong sorts of people as any other large organization. This was a business that involved heavy drinking on both sides of the Cold War, and officers and agents frequently took refuge from the stress in the blurring of reality that alcohol can bring. The peculiarly demanding relationship between agent and agent runner is often oiled by the convivial, disinhibiting effects of drink. Unlike other branches of government, secret services tend to recruit imaginative people who have what Winston Churchill called corkscrew minds. If the marks of potential treachery are being clever, eccentric, and inclined to have a few too many drinks, then half the wartime and post-war spies in Britain and America would have been suspect. But in this respect, the KGB was different, since it officially frowned on both inebriation and individuality. Gordievsky's betrayal was invisible because he was sober and outwardly conformist. Bettany went undetected because he was not. The Nadja team, meanwhile, had narrowed down the mole hunt to three suspects, with Bettany at the top of the list. But putting him under surveillance posed problems. Bettany knew the A4 surveillance teams well, and had been trained to spot when he was being followed. If he recognized one of the watchers, the game would be up. Moreover, the watchers knew Bettany, and might be unable to resist leaking to others in MI5 that their colleague was being monitored. Instead of using the professionals of MI5, therefore, it was decided to deploy the MI6 Nocturne team, none of whom were known to Bettany. The Director General of MI5 explicitly vetoed the use of MI6 officers in an MI5 operation. Devril ignored the order. The MI6 officers in the Gordievsky case would shadow Bettany and try to catch him in the act of treachery. Bettany was given the codename Puck, an unpopular choice among the Nadjas. The Shakespearean connection was deemed highly inappropriate by all members of the team, and the word itself was too close to a well-known Anglo-Saxon expletive for comfort. On the morning of July 4th, a dishevelled couple in tattered clothes could be seen lounging aimlessly at the end of Victoria Road, Coulston, in the South London suburbs. One was Simon Brown of P5, MI6's head of Soviet bloc operations. The other was Veronica Price, the architect of Gordievsky's escape plan. A home county's creature from her pearls to her twin set, Price was not suited to this sort of subterfuge. "I've borrowed the Tsar's hat," she announced, as they climbed into their disguises. At 8:05, Michael Bettany emerged from number 5, paused at the front gate of his home, and looked up and down the street. "That moment I knew it was him," said Brown. "No one does that unless they are guilty and looking for signs of surveillance." Bettany did not give the down-and-outs a second glance, nor did he spot the pregnant woman a little way down the carriage on the 8:36 train from Coulston town, nor the balding man who tailed him on the 10-minute walk from Victoria Station to the MI5 building in Curzon Street. That day, Bettany took a 2-hour lunch break, but at some point he was lost in the lunchtime crowds. MI5 could not be sure whether he had gone to Hanover Square to check if the resident had finally signalled the willingness to play ball by parking his car on the north side, which Cook had not. Frustrated and increasingly anxious, Bettany resolved to make one more effort to coax the KGB into cooperation. After midnight on July 10th, he dropped a third letter through Cook's letterbox. This asked for an indication of whether the earlier packages had been received, and what the Soviet response might be. He proposed to call the Soviet embassy switchboard on July 11th at 8:05 a.m. and ask for Gook by name. The resident should answer and indicate, by a specific form of words, whether or not he was interested in Koba's trove of secrets. Why MI5 did not have Gook's property under tight surveillance, and thus spot the spy making his third delivery, remains a mystery. Gordievsky was now in Moscow, and not in a position to tip off his British friends to this latest approach. But in any case, Bettany was incriminating himself in various ways suggestive of intense mental strain, and possibly some sort of breakdown. On July 7th, he discussed Gook with colleagues in a manner that struck them as obsessional, and suggested the KGB resident should be recruited by MI5. The next day he remarked that even if the KGB was offered a peach of a source, they would reject it. He began asking odd questions about specific KGB officers and showing an interest in files outside his immediate remit. He spoke at length about the motivations of spies from the past, including Kim Philby. On the morning of July 11th, he called the Soviet embassy from a public telephone, identified himself as Mr. Koba, and asked to speak to Gook. The KGB station chief declined to pick up the phone. 3 times, Bettany had presented the KGB chief with a valuable gift horse. Each time, Gook had looked it squarely in the mouth. Intelligence history offers few comparable examples of such an opportunity squandered. 3 days later, Bettany asked an MI5 colleague, "How do you think Gook would respond if a British intelligence officer put a letter through the door of his house?" This was the clincher. Koba was Michael Bettany. But the evidence against Bettany was circumstantial. His telephone had been tapped without producing any result. His house was subjected to a cursory search, without uncovering anything incriminating. Bettany was covering his tracks with professional efficiency. For a successful prosecution, MI5 needed to catch him in the act of treachery or secure a confession. The Gordievsky family returned from their holiday on August 10th. At the first meeting in the Bayswater safe house since his return, Gordievsky was told that while there was now a definite suspect, the spy in MI5 had not yet been arrested. Back at the KGB Residentura, he made casual inquiries as to whether the dangle by the mysterious Koba had progressed in his absence, but learned nothing new. He attempted to resume his normal routine, cultivating contacts for the KGB and gathering intelligence for MI6, but it was hard to focus, knowing that there was still a spy at liberty, somewhere inside British intelligence. Clearly, this person had been unaware that Gordievsky was spying for Britain when he first posted his letter to Gook. But that was now more than 4 months ago. Had Koba discovered the truth in the interim? Had Gook agreed to take him on, and were his KGB colleagues even now watching him, waiting for him to make a slip? Every day that the spy remained uncaught, the threat increased. He picked up the girls from school, took Leila out to dinner, listened to Bach, and read his books, trying to appear unperturbed as the anxiety steadily mounted. Would his friends in MI6 catch the nameless spy before the spy caught him? Bettany, meanwhile, apparently tired of waiting for Gook to respond, had decided to take his illicit wares elsewhere. At the office, he let slip that he was thinking of taking a holiday in Vienna, a center of Cold War espionage with a large KGB residentura. A search of his cupboard at work turned up documents referring to a KGB officer expelled from the UK in Operation Foot, who was now living in Austria. Bettany, it seemed, was about to fly the coop. MI5 decided to haul him in and attempt to extract a confession. It was a huge gamble. If Bettany denied everything and resigned from the service, he could not be legally prevented from leaving the country. The plan to confront Bettany, codenamed Co, might backfire. We could not guarantee success, MI6 warned, pointing out that if Bettany played his cards right, he might walk away at the end of the day free to do what he wants. Above all, the interception of Bettany must not be traceable to Gordievsky. On September 15th, Bettany was summoned to a meeting at MI5's Gower Street headquarters to discuss an urgent counterintelligence case that had arisen. Instead, on arrival, he was taken to a flat on the top floor, and the evidence against him was laid out by John Deverell and Eliza Manningham Buller, including a photograph of Gook's front door, intended to imply that he had been seen making his deliveries, which he had not. Bettany was shocked and visibly nervous, but in control. He spoke hypothetically about what this theoretical spy was supposed to have done, without ever indicating that he had done anything at all. He noted that it would not be in his interest to confess, an implicit admission, but hardly a confession. Even if he had acknowledged his guilt, the evidence would not have been admissible, since he had not been arrested and no lawyer was present. MI5 wanted him to tell all, then arrest him, and get him to confess again after being advised of his rights. But he did not. Bugs relayed the conversation to the monitoring room below, where a bank of senior MI5 and MI6 officers craned to catch every word. Listening to his attempts to avoid admitting anything was an excruciating experience, said one. Bettany might be unstable, but he was not stupid. We had a very real fear that Bettany would succeed in bluffing it out. By evening, everyone was exhausted, and no nearer a breakthrough. Bettany agreed to spend the night in the flat, though MI5 had no legal right to detain him. He had refused to eat lunch and now declined dinner. He demanded a bottle of whiskey, which he drank steadily. Manningham Buller and two other minders listened sympathetically, occasionally asking disingenuous questions, as he expressed his admiration for the battery of evidence MI5 had gathered, without admitting its truth. At one point he began referring to the British as "you" and the Russians as "us." He admitted that he had wanted to warn the KGB officers that they were under surveillance, but he did not confess. At 3 a.m. he finally collapsed into bed. The next morning, Manningham Buller cooked him breakfast, which he did not eat. Sleepless, hungover, hungry, and exceptionally ill-tempered, Bettany announced he had no intention of confessing. But then he suddenly abandoned the hypothetical form of speech and switched to the first person. He began referring sympathetically to Kim Philby and George Blake, the earlier Cold War spies. Deverell was out of the room when Bettany turned to the interrogators at 11:42 and declared, "I think I ought to make a clean breast of it. Tell Director Kay I wish to make a confession." It was entirely in character for the impulsive Bettany to hold out adamantly for so long and then suddenly buckle. Within the hour, he was in Rochester Row Police Station making a full confession. A more intensive search of 5 Victoria Road revealed proof of his espionage. In a Philips electric shaver box were details of KGB officers he intended to contact in Vienna. Photographic equipment was discovered under rubble in the coal cellar. The laundry cupboard contained undeveloped film of classified material. In a cardboard box, under a layer of glasses,